Hey guys, welcome back to Honeycomb. My name is KO, and this is All Things Creative, where we talk about all things that are creative. Our belief is that everybody who works here is creative because we believe that all things are creative, right? Whether that be engineering or planning or the stuff that we more traditionally think of as creative. We believe that creative problem solving is a real thing. And to discuss that, we actually have one of our original members here in Honeycomb. We've spoken to him before on our YouTube channel, but this is, we're kind of doing an update on everyone. So I'd like to welcome to our studio today, our member since 2019, yeah, Ilek Diaz of Liter of Light.
Feels like Avengers pre-pandemic. It's just almost didn't exist, a world before.
Yeah, completely different, right? Why don't you tell us, for those who don't know, maybe in maybe 1 minute, what is Liter of Light? What do you guys do?
So Liter of Light is works like ambassador of UNESCO, and UNESCO is the Education and Science Division, right? So we work with them, and
of the UN.
Of the UN.
Okay.
So we work with them because there's the newest platform, which is called the International Day of Light. It's to give relevance to the 1 billion people plus that don't have access to electricity. Now, what we do is really approached it from 13 million Filipinos and try to give them access to light. And to do that, we look at solar with local parts and local skills to develop products, reading lights, mobile chargers, street lights, to give them this kind of access.
So that's the number that we're at now. There's 13 million Filipinos who do not have access to light.
So that's why I'm staying here for so long. I was actually hoping, you know, to solve this when they say change the world. I was hoping this to solve this in about 3-4 years. But, you know, they never tell us how big the problem is.
Yeah. So it's Liter of Light itself, the let's call it the product, right, is a light. It's a lantern that's built and sent. It's built in the area where it's going to be used.
Yeah.
And then it gets deployed to one of these 13 million people who are usually on some island somewhere, right?
Well, it's more of a process because we didn't invent the process.
Mm-hmm.
There are problems, let's say housing, and people don't want to donate the house. Therefore, what Gawad Kalinga did in Habitat for Humanity is convince corporates to buy the materials, give the people, you know, the corporate volunteers to build it, working with the locals, and this materials gets built into a house. And the process is that these people would also lend their skills to make a house, right? So Liter of Light basically follow that same thing. Local parts for solar are now available. So we get corporates, you know, schools, you know, private members to donate the material. But we don't have a factory in any of our 32 countries. We make them build it, and then we work with the communities. They get it for free, so we get a percentage, of the operations. And then we give it for free to the local, you know, women's cooperative where they can maintain it and maintain it, right? And they can now rent it instead of selling kerosene that used to be the most expensive part of a village, you know,
operation,
income.
Yeah.
They now switch it into solar, which each time lasts 5 years, and then you can fix everything with it. So we get the money from corporates because before nobody gives light. Nobody will donate the light. But the process of being part of making the light and giving it, it was the real breakthrough. So it's a participative social enterprise.
So these corporations, they have large amounts of employees, and as a CSR activity, right? Instead of just giving money, they act as
the builders.
So they act as like the factory hands, right? So it's like you're donating your labor.
You're buying the materials,
right?
For the
workshop.
You're
buying the materials, yeah. So the company is buying the materials.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the employees are donating their labor.
Yeah.
And all of this is a way of connecting the donation, right, to a physical act that these people are able to
do. The social enterprise is the process, and then it donates because
the finished
product. we don't double dip, right? So
yeah.
we earn for throwing the workshop together, and then with the products we give it to the women for free, where they now can make a business out of it, which is, you know, getting rid of kerosene, which they have to go to the city to buy, and now maintaining this stock of solar lights. Now, what's interesting about the whole process is also expansion. Once you start teaching people how to build solar lights in the village, their entrepreneurial nature is that they would ask us where to buy the parts, which we do. To solve the 13 million problem, you don't want to be, you know, the patented technological, you know, you don't want to hold the secret sauce.
Yeah.
You actually want to teach it, because small NGOs such as ours, we replicate this kind of leadership. So we get them and we handhold them to go to, let's say, Sagada, Baguio. We look for where the parts are, LEDs for motorcycles.
In that area. So there's already a supply chain to get the parts there.
Right. So the point of this is that if they want to replicate it and scale it based on the profits that they're now... Remember, 35% of their income from, I don't know, selling vegetables or fish or whatever goes to kerosene, or to burn it in terms of petrol, carbon-based, right? Burn it. So we're now moving to solar, where they can keep it, because the only way that you charge is not mechanical. It's an radiance, right? So you convert that one into electro. So they can now keep the money for education, for more solar. So what magic here that people don't understand is they now can replicate it without you. So the way that we feel to do this is, as we're a social enterprise earning from bringing, you know, lights over there, we treat it as a, you know, as a starter kit for them to start earning from that business and then scaling. So let's say 100, hopefully in 2-3 years they have 400, 500 without us. So that's, you know, that's part of the story that that people don't hear, that, you know, if I'm there, I have to be messianic. If I'm not there, then, you know, you have to wait for me. We really don't believe in that. We believe in the capacity of each person to, you know, to be a solar engineer anytime, you know, anywhere.
So that's how you address a big problem like 13 million.
Yeah.
Which is, you could never do the 13 million.
No. Nor do I want to. I don't want to be called, you know, I don't know, in a Visayas island and say, hey, we have a couple of broken products. Can you come and fix them, right?
So, yeah. So you're basically teaching a man to fish.
Or Brazil. I mean, 32 countries. You know, you don't want to get a call from the Rohingya tribes in Bangladesh and say, hey, you know, 3,000 of your lights is broken, right? You just don't want that to happen. So it was, how do you save the world? And the reason is not that, you know, it will take me to save the world. It actually is, if we do this like the Philippines, like Bayanihan, if we help everybody become as good as me, as technically, you know, entrepreneurial as me, force this kind of energy poverty, then we can scale it rapidly, like, you know, like a huge ice bucket challenge.
So, all right. So you deployed to all these countries, right? We have a 13 million problem here. What's the numbers like globally?
So it's 750,000, but 1.2 billion is the one that we're looking at, because not everybody can keep on, you know, like, for example, when you go to Brazil, they only have 4 hours of generator power because they only have that much money. So really, it's like people are living half poverty, or people living in whole, because it's petrol-based, or the prices of electricity are just too expensive, just like here in Metro Manila, right?
Well, we say Metro Manila, but you go to the provinces, it's actually more expensive.
Well, what's really interesting is some of the places with geothermal and solar plants, because they have to go into large-scale debt to be able to purchase this, they actually fly over the energy-poor community. So really, it's really a matter of this kind of access. One interesting number, you know, let's say a refugee camp, right? There's now more migrants. Although we'd like to talk about energy poverty for people with a house without power, there are more climate migrants and war migrants moving, people moving without a stable address than anywhere in the world. Those are the things that Litter of Light is also addressing. You know, when you say energy poverty, a lot of it are refugee camps moving. And so for us, we have to figure out a way for them to be able to maintain it and replicate it, and as they're moving, right?
How do you find these groups?
So we work a lot with, you know, there's UNESCO. You call it UN OCHA, right? So we look at the numbers. It's widely published. The Litter of Light is basically focusing on that. Like, if we can start teaching communities to be able to look for sustainable energy with local parts and local skills, then more of that money can be local. Question, how does such a small nonprofit help, let's say, 350 villages, right?
Yeah.
I must be out of my mind trying to say, you know, we're going to light up the world, because
there's six of you here.
We're six of us here. There's 50 of us in Mandaluyong.
Okay.
How do you do that? Well, all the farmers or fishermen, they have to go to Manila to bring their goods. Mm-hmm. That's where the most money. So they have jeeps, communal transportation, buses. They all go to Manila, dump it, and then they go back empty. They call it empty cargo, right? There's no backhaul. But it's the same guy bringing it and the same guy going back all the way, right?
Yeah.
So basically, you can give the parts to this guy, and for sure, you know, it'll get to the women cooperative there. So by building a supply chain where we can not only deliver the lights, but we can maintain it because of this, you know, if you want to call it farm to town or farm to market. There's also a market to back to the farm to maintain these thousands of lights without me physically having to go there every month.
Yeah, by just taking this supply chain that's unidirectional and making it bi-directional.
Yeah,
that's very creative.
Think about this globally, right, from Litter of Light. The same group you see here is the same group that you will see in Brazil, except they have 30. They're bigger.
Yeah.
And so,
bigger country.
They don't import or export. We built it in a sense that they get the products there. So if they have to scale it from 10 to 1,000, it won't take them months to import it from China or India. They basically have all the parts there already. So I built everything from, you know, Egypt to Senegal to, you know, Congo. They all have operations where all their parts are available there. Of course, they don't have recycled plastic, so they have to use pottery. Dominican Republic, for the province Haiti, we had to use bamboo. So each country has their own formula. What you see here with recycled plastic and that is because we're an island and I need it to be as waterproof as possible.
Yeah. Also, we're kind of at the forefront of you know, this heavy onslaught of super storms, super typhoons.
Right.
Right? So it's a day-to-day reality for us.
Five of them destructive. It's becoming so strong that it's cross-country. So before, if you get hit in the Philippines, there would be aid that comes here. But now it goes straight into Taiwan, into Vietnam. It's this kind of super typhoons just...
It's hitting everyone at the same time.
And so aid is now dispersed.
Yeah.
And less comes to compensate for... That's why... In the next climate change conference in COP28 in the UAE, you know, before we used to talk about this feeling that there would be enough time, you know, they say in 2030 that this could be fixed or countries emitting would lower it. But that was kind of a ruse. They are not. They're actually, it's becoming worse. And that's why we're now asking for loss and damage. like we need that money to be able to lessen the number of people hurt.
And that's because they didn't do it. Is that correct?
Well,
like the people who could have, you know, the institutions and organizations, countries that were creating a lot of the damage could have reversed it.
Could have.
But they haven't.
There was a lot of hope. There was a lot of science behind it. I mean, most scientists already know that it's for certain. But it became a way of tricking the developing countries, because before, the measurement used to be by country, like the United States, China. I mean, it used to be by country, but suddenly, it became everybody's problem by parts per million. So they said, you know, you can't cross 350 parts per million, and we're all part of the same ocean of carbon emission. So it stopped pointing fingers. It was really a great chess move by moving away from, you know, countries with the most pollution, right?
Yeah.
And what happened is, of course, you also have that the biggest speakers, especially for developing countries, are, you know, mostly from that country. They don't even travel here. They just look at the data and they say, oh. But before, there used to be very clear heroes and villains. And not to say villains, but polluting villains, right? Not all companies are bad. They're very good ones. But what happened was, before, companies that did not care about employees, that you would hurt them, would violate the humanitarian rules, labor rules, they would be about society. So what about society? Companies that don't care about society. But the biggest is environment. And then civil groups would come together and they would protest. They would, you know, they would stop these kind of operations. What corporates did very smartly, which is, I'm going to get to the climate very soon, is the fact that they put up corporate foundations. And the corporate foundations would basically be a tax-deductible vehicle for them to mimic. Not all, but many of them would just mimic, you know, this one says you're cutting trees, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this one would plant trees. So they said, okay, we plant more trees. So that way, they would become the good guys. And so the public that used to be able to see through, you know, this veil of corporate secrecy would say, you know, this is the bad guys, therefore they need to be good, and so lost. But now, suddenly they had an NGO, which was, you know, one of the tree plantings. They used the same language as the NGOs, you know, commune with nature. But actually, they've destroyed just, you know, a huge amount already, and continue to destroy it. But this thing about using corporate foundations to mask or to PR themselves out of a problem, and not all, but this is the same thing that they're using for countries. They're using great, you know, greenwashing. Without people actually calling them out on it, now they are. But to be able to say, "Hey, we're not the villains here. We're with you."
Yeah.
But if you look at the emission statistics, it's just going through the roof. So that's why when I said this movement, like for example, there's no way that individuals, if they, the best of us, the private sector, becomes perfect at not using plastic, subdividing their trash. There's no way that it would actually stop plastic pollution, because the greatest emitter of it is corporates. The thing there, the PR there, is to throw the, you know, to think of this as a public problem.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with carbon emissions. Without the corporates doing it.
So this is why we have all this stuff where people are like, oh, we can solve this by not using drinking straws, right? Or, you know, by recycling.
There's no way. There's such a small amount that the private sector could do if the corporates decide not to do it. So it's the same thing with country emission. There's no way that even if all the developing countries, which is the least, you know, polluter or contributors, if you look at, you know, if you keep saying about, yeah, everybody, you can't cross 350 parts per million per million, but the strongest emitters mask these things in instead of being called out or having the greatest climate strikes or whatever. There's no way that this thing will serve. So some of the biggest advocates are saying, we need to call people out. They need to pay loss and damages because they don't seem to honor their truth.
So
right?
who should we be calling out?
So basically,
do they have names? You can.
Petrol companies, which used to have such a great, there was such a great hope. Cristiana Figueres, there was, the UN Gutierrez. They said, look, petrol companies should not be part anymore of the climate change conference because they have gotten in and they've basically just taken over it. And knowing fully well, when they say 2050 or 2030, they don't have to do anything till then. And even after the pandemic, they're back to their old ways. So in fact, they said, look, we prioritize shareholders. So the whole thing about corporates, they're doing good, but shareholders are their ultimate reason for they're being established.
Yeah. Legally, they have to.
Well, legally and the function. So I'm not saying anything, but our way of creating capital is destructive. A lot of the corporates, when they operate, they don't have to pay an environmental damage. Because if a lot of corporates, if they had to pay the environmental damage that they created, getting water for mineral water, they would go bankrupt. So that, I think that that's it. And that's why 5 times of the world is being consumed. So 1 time is to be able to heal itself, but we're using 5 times the capacity of the earth. Now, once again, this is what it is, right? And we're trying to solve it, but that's one of the big challenges. And that's why when you say COP28, right, what's happening, it's 28 years that we've been meeting. And so they say, we're going to make a big difference in 2050. But that's like, hey, don't get mad now. But you know what? In 5 years, we'll fix it. Back to the question why litter of light is. This litter of light is supposed to be not only lighting, it's really emergency lighting. So when these kind of superstorms hit, like Haiyan 10 years ago, that there's a way for the locals to gather thousands of people to create solar lights, emergency solar lights. It's a way to get it to them as fast as possible from 1 week as compared to before 5 months, right? So I mean it's just too long. If you have to import it and it's too expensive, the 60% to 80%, right? So how many you have to times two it sometimes. And so there it's litter of light addresses it, but we also understand just what a challenge it will be in the next generations to be able to tackle 250, 300 kilometer per hour winds.
How does one not feel helpless against these giant they're you might be in 32 countries, but you're still a very small organization.
Yeah, yeah. We're
in comparison.
That's right? Why we...
How do you not feel hopeless against all of... That's something I'm starting to confront. I have small kids, right? And I read about it all the time, about like Gen Z feeling hopeless about the state of the environment. How does one confront that on a day-to-day basis? Because I see you guys here working every day towards this goal, knowing that you're up against something that's so big and powerful, it's almost literally screaming into the typhoon, screaming into the storm. How do you deal with that on a day-to-day basis, on a personal level, as an organization?
So the model is to create leadership. So in the other countries, they don't even know Vanilac Diaz. They, of course, in the foundation, they know that, you know, I created the money to be able to donate to them $5,000-$10,000 to start their movement. We have great hope, and that's why we go straight to the villages, right? So all of these things with the corporates to be enable us to start our, we call it a shift, right? We're shifting from kerosene to solar. We know that even though huge blackouts happen, the villages that we take care of has continued to have lights, street lights. I guess you have to look, you know, like Obama. I mean, the audacity of hope, right? So when everything seems bleak, you know, the long arm of the law, the long arm of social justice, it's always the long arm, right? But when you watch movies, you know, my wife, Amy, she sort of like jokes that I like looking at, these disaster movies. And I tell her, it's because human beings on the 11th and 30 minutes and 45 minutes or the 11th and 50th minute, they still will come together and do the right thing. So
you have a belief in humanity. Hope in humanity.
I do.
That there are greater amounts of people who want to do good.
Well, I've traveled around the
versus
world.
Versus the capability?
I've traveled around the world, and there are more good people than bad people.
No, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But does the amount of good that this majority of good people can do, does it outpace the evil of these organizations that you're speaking of that need to be called out?
I believe that the communication should be, we're not saving the world. We're actually saving ourselves. It's because the world, in all its, you know, in all its history, really does not need human beings. It's because if things go haywire and superstorms happen, the world will continue. The world will keep on shifting. But this Anthropocene period where man has so affected the atmosphere, you would have never think about it. When you know, I took this trip around the world. It took me 100 days by ship to go around the world. It's so big. You cannot believe that human beings would actually be able to affect so much of the world, but it's happening. And so if we don't stop, it will have certain dire consequences.
It's like like the dinosaurs, the theory is that they got wiped out by an asteroid, right? By an asteroid that hit the Earth. But when you think about that, this thing that destroyed all those creatures, humans are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Like,
well, the world healed, right? After that.
A few, you know, a couple billion years.
The same thing with what's going to happen with this one. The humans would suffer, but the world will move on for a couple of, you know.
So that's what you're saying. The earth doesn't need us.
Then the earth does not need it. But our children living on the earth.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was so touched by this thing with William Shatner. He's Star Trek. I'm a Trekkie, so I just love. And so he got to go out into outer space.
Yeah.
And he says, for all my career, I was telling people about the amazing, you know, things to see in space, and there's a lot. But when he finally crossed the thin crust, you know, the thin layer of atmosphere, which only a couple of kilometers thick, he said, I suddenly felt this iciness, this coldness that I was wrong the whole time. I was asking people to look into space when it was such a horrible place to be in. Not out there, but, you know, and looking down, that is where it was warm and, you know, life was happening. And so he said, it was only when I went into space did I realize life all along was, you know, where we should be protecting, right?
Yeah.
In terms of the Philippines having the worst environmental record right? The most number of deaths of environmentalists. It's also concerning in the sense that when you kill off a generation of environmentalists, you lose a generation of people that have dedicated themselves to be able to study environment and be able to, you know, to make policy about the environment. But you're talking about 20, 30, 40 years to recreate that kind of movement. Yes, okay, you know, they defend the forest, but, you know, if a power that be decides to get rid of them, you lose a whole lifetime of somebody that defends...
to get to that position.
Not only are they be losing them, but we're losing people that actually know how to solve problems because they know how to be able to look for medicines. They know how to be able to recreate forests. This generation that, you know, when they say, oh, you know, Philippines has the worst and most number of environmentalists dying. Some of them, as I said, you know, anger people. But at the same time, if you don't find a way to coexist and just eliminate them, you're looking at a whole generation that does not know what to do and how to recreate this kind of forestry that we have so little of. And so if young people are less conscious now, it's because we've lost a generation of people that communicate or are well versed in the environment, that go out into the environment. There are people that don't care about the environment, but because a lot of them, they never had the chance to go to the forest. Many young people today don't care about environmentalists and because they've lost the people that would bring them out there, that would bring them to educate them.
All right, so that's a big problem, right, that we're trying to solve. We're addressing a global problem.
8 billion. You're talking about 8 billion people on this earth, right?
With that said, what does the rest of 2023 look like? What does the last 4 years look like for Leader of Light for you guys?
So, you know, I don't want, you know, this thing is, you know, we're talking about the problem, but I just wanted to balance it out with a statement that there is hope, right? Mm-hmm. But that hope is premised that people do their share. So in the world where people say, oh, there are NGOs and there's government to handle it, you'll understand that, you know, if people don't do their share, that means other people have to take up that burden. So there's a way to solve it. We're hoping, you know, we're hoping to inspire more of these people, not, you know, that got scared about being part of the environmental, you know. And so we're trying to do this documentary to inspire people that changes from the Philippines can go around the world. We hope to double the number of people making lights because it's all our stock is every major storm, it just disappears. Our you know, our emergency solar lighting system is just it just disappears with the number of places that are hit at the same time. And that's why Litter of Light, in its really small way, is trying to get as much solar lights in villages, because when it hits, there's not gonna be any kerosene runs for you. When there is disaster that strikes, it's better for the villages to know how to have mobile charging system, street lights, to be able to, you know, to have some light as they go through the storm. That doesn't have to have a part that comes from Metro Manila, right? They have their own store. So the future of these kind of stores, for me, or inside a classroom where they have to, you know, weather the storm, is to be able to have their own way of having light, right? So when you ask me, what is Litter of Light? It's designed to be, an emergency solar lighting system that is, you know, that is people-based, that has parts there, because we know that that the storms are going to hit, and so they need some kind of emergency lighting. And so that's what it was built for. And in times of peace, when there's no superstorms, it's supposed to solve energy poverty. Honestly, long-term problems, you need serious people with serious skills, right? And sometimes when you have these serious problems and serious skills, you become very passionate and adamant to voice it out. But if you voice it out and, you know, somehow through a series of events, unfortunate events, you lose your life or people scare you to death, You know, what
no one is getting scared.
What kind of
getting actually killed?
What kind of environmentalists? You know, it's one of the world's biggest crises, right? So
it is the crisis.
You need people that are passionate. They know what they're doing, science. But you cannot get rid of, you know, you cannot get rid of this strata of people just because they bristle the government, right? So I'm just saying, there must be a middle way, because if you lose a whole generation, and this kind of climate change takes, what, you know, seven years, 10 years, to replace all of them, it's going to take another 20 years to get, you know, to get the next generation.
Nobody's thinking, let's be realistic, no one, at least in our government, actually, governments everywhere around the world, no one thinks in those windows of time.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Term limits are really short.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, oh, I got 6 years to get stuff done. Realistically, I'm only really working for four of those years, right? Because 1 year is going to be just like setting stuff up. The last year is like a lame duck situation, right? So it's actually really difficult.
When I talk about environmentalists, I mean, say, like, what kind of trees to plant? What are those, you know, what are edibles? What are, you know, what I'm saying is, it takes a whole lifetime to be able to develop this kind of skill. To lose that, it's just not even a cultural loss. Even just young people that speak, you know, just speak that there is a crisis to other young people, that there is a crisis, and that, you know, they cannot, you know, keep on living their days as if nothing's going to happen. It's very important. It's very important that we have people that can communicate. Like, I can't communicate to young people. I have a hard time, because, you know, there are this kind of, you know, this kind of communication to each, you know, to each generation. So that's why Greta is so popular with young people. It's because she knows how to communicate something that us, you know, it's even tough to talk to friends about, you know, about it, right? The people that know most about how to act on it are the people that I feel we're losing, or they're being shamed.
We have to value them in that respect.
I mean, they're the life. They're the people that operates the machinery that works the lifeboats, right?
Yeah. All right. So we've been going for more than an hour now. So this is actually how Ilek and I just sit around and talk sometimes. I think it's very cathartic. Like, it's a catharsis for both of us, right? To be able to discuss some of these things and get stuff that's just kind of in our head out there. But for the sake of podcasting, really, having some thread of continuity or lightness, whatever, across. I'm going to ask you a couple questions.
Yeah,
you know a lot of people. Like, sometimes I'll be surprised, like, Ilek will start talking about, you know, the king of this country, or Al Gore, or James Cameron, and, like, it's completely true. Like, it's he's not, like, just telling stories. It's actually dudes who he knows. So I actually think, I ask this question to almost everyone who I interview, for whatever reason, and I think this is going to be a really interesting answer from you. Because you actually get to meet a lot of people who ordinary folks around don't get to meet. The question is, if you could sit down for a drink, whether it's a cup of coffee or a cup of cognac, right? A sip of cognac with anyone, alive or dead, for 15, 10 minutes, who would it be? And what would you ask them?
So my wife is, you know, I'm a fan of John Cusack. It just so happens that, you know, people think that he's out of his mind sometimes, but, you know, he has one of those things where he talks about things that people don't like to talk about, but he does it in such a way that is really interesting. I was thinking, you know, if it's the end of the world, I wouldn't mind having, you know, watching, you know, he did the disaster films, you know, and just, you know, understanding, like, you know, how...
Hanging out with John Cusack. What would you ask John Cusack?
Oh,
I gotta say, it's like one of the most random answers I've ever heard.
Yeah,
but okay, yeah. What would you ask John Cusack?
A life is too short for boring, boring people. I have an extreme attraction for people who have a different choice in life. What I'm saying is the world is so big, so amazing, that we have to have that point where we've done what our parents tell us and what society tells us, and start writing our own script to move out there. And so I'm just saying, it just takes longer, but it's so worth it, hanging out with the craziest people that you can. Not drugs or anything. I'm just saying that.
Sex.
People. There are people out there that have incredible lives, and sometimes it's just a matter of you asking if you can be friends with them or hang out with them.
So this is what you would ask John Cusack? Can we be
friends? I would write to him. Now that I think about it, like if things go haywire, you know, you would just like to have a gin and say, hey, remember 2012 when you tried to warn the world about, you know, the apocalypse? And John Cusack, I like his films.
All right. I think that's good. So we're gonna talk to everyone here, right? Mm-hmm. Is there something you've always wanted to ask someone here? Not specifically, but, you know, just a question that I can ask the next person on the next podcast. What should I ask them?
Honeycomb is such an interesting thing because it's such a not only creator space, but it's also a solution space. So it's one of the things is how can we use or find a way for the community to sit down and have more chats like this.
Thank you guys so much for joining us. I think that's a pretty good note to end on. If you are enjoying the content, please do subscribe to our YouTube channel. It helps us a lot. You can also get us wherever podcasts are found. So Google Podcasts, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, I think it's what it's called now, Spotify. But of course, we very much appreciate when you watch on YouTube. I know it's long, but it's one of the few places that we get monetization. So that actually does help us a lot. One thing that kept us alive here in Honeycomb during the pandemic was that YouTube page. So we are very appreciative to all of you who watch and listen to the stuff that we're producing here in Honeycomb. We're going to continue making this podcast over the next few months to talk about the different people in our community here who visit us doing things big and small. Leader of Light is on one of the bigger sides of impact in the world. I do hope to get you back at some point, so maybe every few months, every year or something, so that we can do some catch up on where we are in comparison. Maybe it won't be this long because we won't have, you know, we'll be do more of a catch up, right? Versus then this.
When you take this long, I mean, there's a lot more cuento. So but
let's be real. You and I sit down with some microphones. We're gonna talk for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you guys so much for watching.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ila, for joining us. Wish you the best of luck in all the stuff Leader of Light is doing this year and the next 7 years.
Thank you.
All right. Peace.
Till 2012.